Blog.
Readers Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Readers Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Ed English. For those of you who are joining us, you can find us at, you can call in at 1-646-200-4071. I want to go ahead and introduce my co-host. This is our first time working together. Dana Linton and I met each other probably, I'm guessing, 2 or 3 years ago.
At least, yeah.
And,
I think it's been five, Ed.
Dana has graciously agreed to co-host with me tonight. It was actually Dana who brought us this evening's guest. Dana, would you like to introduce him?
I'd be happy to. I met Mark Ryan about 2 years ago at a film festival I was working with, and Mark was one of our guests. And Mark quickly moved to the top of my most fascinating men list and has quite comfortably stayed perched there since. From military man to comedian, singer to swordmaster, robot to Robin Hood, writer to producer, and everything imaginable in between, Mark Ryan is truly a modern-day Renaissance man in every sense of the word. So, without further ado, Mr. Mark Ryan.
Hello, welcome, Mark.
Hello, Ed.
Glad to have you with us tonight.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me. And after an introduction like that from Dana, I don't know if I can say anything now.
You know, it's one of those things that's hard to follow, isn't it?
Well, you are a Renaissance man. I mean, literally, Mark, I don't think there's anything that you haven't done except for maybe have a baby.
I'm pretty sure we can make...
Rule that one out.
That's right.
Yeah, that's not happening anytime soon.
No, but you've got a book coming out April 21st called The Pilgrim. It's a graphic novel that you've done with the famous Mike Grell. And could you tell us a little bit about The Pilgrim and just some interesting little facts about it?
Well, it's a story that's been rumbling around in my head for actually quite some years. I don't know how we are for time, but I know we have quite a bit. So, but it's a story that came out of some investigations I was doing some years ago, and I was told some stories about these psychic battles that had gone on during the Second World War, who was involved with them. And apparently, during the Second World War, Winston Churchill gathered some of the best psychics and magicians in Europe to wage magical and psychical warfare on the Nazi SS. The purpose of this was to was misdirection, because in fact we were reading most of their radio traffic. The ultra decoding machines at Bletchley Park had broken quite a lot of the German encoding machines, and we were kind of breaking them slowly but surely. So they wanted to protect that source of intelligence. And there's a great quote from Churchill, which is, "In war, the truth is so precious that it must always be accompanied by a bodyguard of lies." And anyway, yeah, so basically they gathered these magicians together because they knew that the SS was an occult-based organization. In fact, the Annenerbe, which was a real organization, as in Raiders of the Lost Ark, did go rumbling around the world looking for magical and mystical artifacts to actually help them win the war. Uh-huh. And so they hired these magicians to convince the Nazi hierarchy that we weren't in fact reading their radio traffic, we were in fact reading their minds. And Himmler, and I know it sounds now ridiculous, but Himmler and the SS believed it.
Wow.
And it was so desperate that at this point they would try anything, because at this point America wasn't in the war. It was 1939. We'd just gone through the Battle of Britain, which was a very, very close run thing. I mean, very close indeed. Nobody knows how close we actually came to losing that air battle.
Uh-huh.
And if we just had lost air supremacy over the British Isles, the Germans could have invaded. So we were that close. So Churchill used anything he could to convince the Germans that that wasn't a good idea. And it worked. The Germans believed, for a lot of Germans, particularly Himmler, believed that we were raising ancient mystical forces on the Isle of Albion to protect us from their invasion.
That is so fascinating. I love to hear about that kind of history, because those are things that most people don't know.
No, I mean, it's one of those things that you, if you think about it, it sounds now kind of laughable. But if you think about the dire straits that Britain was in that year from 1939 through 40, I mean, the Germans were bombing London at will, night after night after night, killing thousands of civilians. And we had really no way to stop them. And so Churchill created this group called the London Controlling Section. And this was a very interesting organization. They came up with things, for instance, like The Man Who Never Was. If you've ever seen the film or read the book, The Man Who Never Was, it's a true story about a Major Martin who didn't exist. And they loaded him with all kinds of plans for the invasion of Sicily, I think it was, and turfed him, this body, out of a submarine in the middle of the Mediterranean to convince the Germans that that's where we were going to go next. So they came up with these completely off-the-wall, out-of-the-box ideas. And one of them was this magical group. And on this committee, the London Controlling Section, was then Wing Commander Dennis Wheatley, who had been recruited to this, and Ian Fleming of James Bond fame, his older and smarter brother, Peter Fleming. And so Ian Fleming got a lot of his ideas from for the books, the Bond books, from Peter, who worked the London Controlling Section.
Oh, wow.
Huh.
Isn't he just chock full of information you never would have even thought about?
Well, now, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I read a question, you know, why did Ian Fleming recruit Aleister Crowley?
Yes. Yeah, and that apparently, I mean, I wasn't there, so I can't. There were two reasons. When Rudolf Hess flew to Scotland, the mysterious flight of Rudolf Hess, which has been shrouded in mystery since the end of the Second World War, and that's why they kept Hess locked up in Spandau prison on his own for the rest of the Cold War. Hess thought he was flying to Scotland to meet a secret group of Masons that were seeking to overthrow Churchill as Prime Minister. And it's my belief, although historically this has never been proven, but there's a lot of evidence to point in this direction, that they believe that Edward and Mrs. Simpson would be put back on the throne. And Edward was, in fact, quite a sympathizer with Nazi Germany. And that we would sue for peace. And Hess believed, because he'd been fed, manipulated astrological and magical information, that if he flew on a certain night to Scotland, he would meet with the heads of this group, one of whom was called Sir Ivone Kirkpatrick. And the Kirkpatrick clans were supposed to be allied with the Aryan nation, and had been for thousands of years, according to the Nazi doctrine. So he believed he was meeting this secret Knight Templar organization that was going to cause revolution, overthrow Churchill, and then we would sue for peace. And so Fleming believed that the best man to go and debrief Rudolf Hess was Aleister Crowley. At the time, Crowley was and had been an intelligence agent in the employ of the British Intelligence Service.
I had no idea.
And he was since the First World War, in between the wars. He was, during the First World War and the Second World War, he spent quite a lot of time, actually, here in America, consulting with the FBI, tracking down German groups that may be working here as proposed.
So now, is the Pilgrim kind of your exposition on things that this group may have done? Or is it more a retelling of things that are more historical, true to form?
I brought it into the present day. The basis for this type of operation and the effect it could have was not lost either on the Russians, the Brits, or American intelligence. And the fact that it could actually have these results, whether it was magical or not, whether it was just psychological warfare or not, the fact was that it worked.
Uh-huh.
And so all the way through the Cold War, as you're probably aware, remote viewing, the CIA financed various programs, Grill Flame and Stargate and various other remote viewing programs. And the Russians were reputed to have spent a lot of time and energy recruiting from their own military people with psi gifts, human capabilities, and psychic gifts that they were planning to use in various warfare scenarios. And so it literally went all the way through the Cold War right up until the 80s, and it recently, even 2002, it's been admitted that the British government attempted to recruit psychics to hunt down Osama bin Laden.
I didn't know that.
I couldn't make this up.
No, you can't.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that human nature is drawn to the paranormal. I mean, even as far as our entertainment goes, there was a movie out recently called The Men Who Stare at Goats that was based on some of the American Psy programs that came, I'm sure, came about as part of this stuff from World War II.
The reason it's kind of based on that is because, I say it, even today, when there have been so many studies into the psychological uses and probably abuses of this type of technique, it's very difficult to quantify how it works. I mean, we use a thing in the Pilgrim, a mechanism called the bell. And if you've ever done any research, and again, on the Nazi regime, one of the most secret, top secret things that they were developing was a thing called the bell. And it's believed that the bell was what's called an MDF, a magnetic field disruptor system, that could actually, it didn't defy gravity, it actually used gravity to repel itself to be able to float freely. And some talk about the black triangle UFO as being exactly that, an engineered version, a re-engineered, back-engineered version of this engine that the Nazis were working on during the Second World War. And I believe it's got some designation, I can't remember what the actual black triangle UFO is called, but that apparently is the type of engine that it's being powered by. And so what we use in the Pilgrim, the actual bell is used, however, as a sanitation device to keep the adepts clean, if you like, from what we call sentient exomorphic anomalies. And as one of the characters says when he's talking about what are these things that you're talking to and how do you create them, and one of the characters says, well, we call them sentient exomorphic anomalies, but you can call them demons.
Oh, wow. Now, one thing that was unique about The Pilgrim, it was originally released episodically. Tell us about how that worked, because that's very unique in the graphic novel realm.
It came about because of my friendship, a long-standing, much respected friendship with Mike Grell. And I know Ed, you're a bit of a Mike Grell fan, not to give that away to your listeners. But Mike and I have been friends for a long time. And over various camping and horse riding trips with friends and folks into the Cascade Mountains, we were bouncing around these stories, because Mike very kindly asked me to come up with a story for the Green Arrow 50th anniversary, which we did, I think it's about 97 or something like that, 80, something like that. And
I own it.
You own it? You have it? Mike Grell did the cover, Shay Anton Penza, and just to give you a little inside story, if you go and look at some of the runes on the stones, Shay Anton Penza was having a bit of a joke, but an inside story is, if you actually go and look at some of the runes, you'll see there are hidden messages actually written in the runes. I'll see if you can work out what they are.
I'll have to dig that out and check it out.
So actually, Shay was having a bit of a joke with that. So anyway, we'd done that, and we got that out in front of DC Comics. And we were talking about wanting to work together on something else, because we both had a military background, and we both had the same sort of, you know, horses and archery and all that kind of mad, you know, boy fun stuff. You know, we were all mad into that kind of, you know, all of that the macho type stuff, you know. Dana very, very kindly calls it the Renaissance. I like that. As, you know, usually it's people going, why don't you grow up, you know. But anyway, so we were into all the toys and all that kind of stuff, but mainly into, you know, riding horses into the mountains. And I was telling him the story that had floated through. I did a film many years ago called Who Dares Wins in the UK. Here it was called The Final Option. And it was about the Iranian embassy siege and its breaking by the Special Air Service. And I was out having lunch with the man that had written the book for it, a fellow called George Markstein. And some of your readers may know George Markstein as being one of the co-producers and writers of The Prisoner. And George worked on that extensively with Patrick McGoohan and was one of the script writers and was one of the producers on it. George, we were talking about some of these strange stories from the Second World War, and I was telling him a story that I've been told about a place in Scotland that was a castle where they'd locked up a lot of the people after the Second World War that were members of what was called the Special Operations Executive, who they basically didn't want to be escaping back into normal society. Some of these people were very rich, very famous. In some cases, they came from very aristocratic families. And because of the work they'd done with Special Operations Executive, they'd gone bonkers. They locked them up in this castle in Scotland. And I was telling him this story, which I had been given. He went, yes, I wrote a book about it called The Cooler. And I went, really? He said, yeah. He said, I've written, in fact, The Cooler, and that story about the castle in Scotland is what I based The Prisoner on.
Huh.
And all they did was move the castle from Scotland to Wales, and apparently, and that's what it was based on. So that's the story that George Marcy told me. I'm sure that, you know, Patrick has a slightly different story and had a different story. But that was, and the book exists. You can probably go online and buy it.
And this isn't your only project you've got going on, is it?
Not at the moment, no. We have several things going on at the moment, other than The Wildwood Tarot and various other things.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about The Wildwood Tarot? And that's, tell us how that all came about, the precursor to that, and the whole nine yards, and when that will be released.
Wow. Okay. Many years ago in the 80s, I was in a show called Robin of Sherwood. Hey to all you Robin of Sherwood fans out there. I spent 3 years of my life romping around in Sherwood Forest, playing a character called Nazir, and which was actually the first Arab character written into the Robin Hood legend. And I'm very proud of the fact that he's quietly stayed in the legend ever since, actually. I mean, there wasn't an Arab character in the legend until we did it in Robin of Sherwood, and now every time there is a production of Robin Hood, there's some kind of Moorish or Arab character, so I'm kind of quietly proud of that. And also the fact that apparently I hold the record for killing most people in 1 hour of family viewing in the UK. Which, I know, it's a strange thing to be proud of, but there you go. I actually beat out Ray Winston in that.
I think that's pretty impressive.
We were having a competition to see how many stuntmen we could kill, and I think I beat Ray by two.
Well, speaking of which, you are a master swordsman, are you not?
I am. I've done a lot of sword work throughout my life, and I've been very lucky with the people that I've been trained by, which include Teddy Walsh, who was Ouston Coordinator and Swordmaster on Robin Hood, and of course I work with Bob Anderson on First Night. He hired me as his assistant, and I worked with Richard Gere, God knows, every day for about 8 months. Richard and I would go quietly to the back lot at Pinewood Studios and throw swords at each other. So, that was an amazing experience to work with Bob.
And you coached, or I guess for lack of a better word, you did coach on the show or the film King Arthur, correct?
Yes, I did.
You advised? Okay.
I was actually the swordmaster and fight choreographer on that. So I ended up training Kira and Tira Knightley and Clive Owen and Mads Mikkelsen and Jan Grufford and everybody. So I ended up choreographing all of their fights and plotting out most of the action sequences with the stunt boys, you know, the great Stevie Dent and his stunt team. We ended up plotting up most of that action together and ended up overseeing most of the fights, coordinating most of the fights at least, obviously, but all the sword play and all that choreography, I choreographed all of that.
I'm going to go a little fanboy here. I know you're not old enough to be my father, and no disrespect to my parents, but will you adopt me? First Night, King Arthur, all of those films are among my favorites.
Well, Antoine's version, I think, Antoine Fuqua's version is the best, the director's cut. He kept in a lot of the harder edged elements that got chopped out in the version that was originally released. And I guess, you know, as happens sometimes, the director's got one idea and said, I mean, we all the way through thought we were making Gladiator. And so we went pretty far out on that limb. And Antoine's version, I think, is the best version the director's put. He's the best version of that movie. He kept in a lot of the nuances and the edgy stuff, which you got to have that kind of drama. You need to have that kind of edge to some of those sword fights. You're talking about 5th century battles where it was pretty brutal. And Antoine did a great job in the film. I think he did.
I own it. I own the DVD, the uncut version.
Oh, yeah. I know we've got a question coming up from our chat, but I wanted to make sure that we touch on it here in just a second. You talk about all the action stuff that you've done. I definitely want to touch on the other side of your entertaining in the musical realm after we get to this question. Katie wants to know if she detects a Scott inflection in your accent.
Actually, I was born in Yorkshire, and Yorkshire has got a very sort of, we do tend to flatten out certain vowels and harden some of them up. I guess it comes from, would you believe, the Saxon influence. So things like butter, we tend to say butter and bath and water instead of water. So there's a very, Yorkshire accent is very distinctive, and I can understand why she might have thought it was Scottish. But to be honest with you, I've lived all over the world, so I've probably picked up a little bit of Irish, and a bit of Scottish, and a bit of even Canadian probably is in there somewhere. And obviously now I've lived in Los Angeles for 13 years now. So, but I guess my accent hasn't changed that much. So, but no, it's not Scottish, it's Yorkshire, but good ear. Good ear.
Oh, she's got a great ear. she's a friend of mine, actually.
Ah, there you go, there you go.
Yeah, she is. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your project, Wuthering Heights? I've listened to some of the music, and I've got to say, it is hauntingly beautiful. And you've written the music, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you've written all of the songs, and is this going to be made into a play?
We are literally, I have just partnered with Tom Corby to finish off the whole libretto now. It was planned to be, originally it was a labor of love, and I'll explain that in a minute, but let me give you a little bit of the history. In 1973, 74, my sister was studying for A-levels in the UK, and she had to do a part of a thesis was on English literature in the Bronte. So there was a film version with Anna Quartermass with Tim Dalton, and she was going to go see it a wet Sunday afternoon in Doncaster, and she was going to go on her own. And my mum said, go with your sister and go to the cinema with her. Okay, because it was Sunday afternoon and all the night. Well, yeah, but it's not a James Bond film, and it's not a weird film. I wasn't really that interested. Anyway, I did go to see it with my sister, and I have to say, I was absolutely drawn into this Yorkshire tale, this very dark, passionate, haunting Yorkshire tale, right from the very beginning. And I actually stayed and went back and saw it a second time. I think I saw it probably two or three times during its run in Doncaster. I was just blown away by this story. And it stayed with me for many years. We did a school trip to Harworth, to the Bronte Parsonage, and I got fascinated by the Brontes and this life that they lived, and particularly Emily. Because Emily, I think she was 30 when she died. I think she left the country, which is very unusual in those days. She left the country once and gone to Belgium and come back. So she had actually traveled a little bit. But other than that, she never left Yorkshire. This was the only book she ever wrote, and then she died.
Oh, really? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the only book Emily Bronte wrote. And so I was curious, I was fascinated to know what was going on in these women's minds that Emily Bronte could have come up with such a monstrous character as Heathcliff.
Oh, yeah.
This incredible, haunting, powerful love story. Where did that come from? And that was partly what I was, an amazing story. And so it stayed with me you know, I'd read the book and I was just blown away by the book. And it followed me all my life. And I started working on this probably, I don't know, probably in the late 80s. And it's been one of those projects that sometimes just has taken time to ferment. And, I recorded some demos in the late 80s and 90s. We don't call them demos now. I don't think anybody calls demos anymore. I'm kind of happy with them. And I like the way the music was going. And, you know, I to answer the question, I had a background in musical theatre. I spent the first 8 years of my life in London, probably in musical theatre, 10 years in West End shows. So it seemed like a natural progression. And then a couple of years ago, I kind of dusted off those demos and was playing them to somebody and went, you know what, this is not bad. Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to pull this out of the cupboard and reinvent it. And so we started work on it. And it was only meant to be a 6 to 8 song cycle originally, because I wanted to work with Jen Corby, you know, and I wanted to work with Rob, who worked on Spamalot. And as you know, I toured with Eric Idle and the Monty Python guy, and Rob had worked with Eric on Spamalot. So I went, you know what, this would just be a fun thing to do, to drag this out and see. But the reaction has been quite interesting. So we are now going to follow, there are 18 completed songs, and we need to put it into a framework a la Evita or a la any of those other shows that I've been involved with, which is mainly sung. So it is again, to date myself, a rock opera.
So you're working towards that then, so hopefully soon, you know, in relatively short history, we can look forward to seeing it.
Absolutely. I'm hoping to have this done probably by the end of this year now.
Well, now, where can people go to listen to some of those songs? Because I know you sent me the link, a year ago or so, and you had 6 songs at the time, and they were just all absolutely incredibly beautiful, and I'm sure our listeners would love to be able to have an opportunity to hear some of those as well.
Well, in fact, yes, there is a website. If you just type in Mark Ryan Wuthering Heights, the website. And as you'll hear, the 4 songs and the video that we recorded for one of the songs called Women, the version is actually narrated by Ray Winston. I got Ray, my old mate from Logan and Sherwood, to come in and narrate as Lockwood. So you can actually listen to Ray narrating as Lockwood the 4 songs. But since then, we've actually recorded more songs. I just haven't released them yet. We've recorded and mastered several more songs, which, you know, it's a slow process, and it's taken its time. And one of the reasons is, not to sound sentimental, my mother asked me actually 2 or 3 years ago, you know, she's very happy with becoming a giant alien robot and all that kind of thing. She actually said to me, but are you ever going to sing again? Are you going to sing anything? And I went, you know what, I should do this before I get too old to sing again. So that's one of the reasons why. It was purely for my mum.
And Mark's reference to a giant robot is because you've done the voices for Transformers, the movie, correct?
Indeedy.
Okay.
I voiced Bumblebee and I voiced Jetfire, but actually on the set I'm usually all of the robots at one time most of the time. So, yes, I get to play all of them. And on the second one, on Revenge, I actually went in and recorded, I don't know, 30 or 40 pages of dialogue for the robots. You know, quite a lot of it ends up on the cutting room floor, so I have to come up with new voices and try new things. And in this one, they ended up keeping Jetfire again, which I'm very proud of, being SR-71.
I need to pause for just a second. We're almost out of time for the live portion of our show. I want everybody to know that Mark has agreed to stick around for a few minutes, and we can continue our conversation. Anything that you do not hear will be on the podcast, which should be available tomorrow. So if you're listening to this now, check out the podcast. There'll be some bonus material. So I wanted to get that out there. Mark, for anybody who might not be able to get to the podcast, where can they find out more about you?
Where can you find out about me? Oh, wow. If you just type in Mark Ryan, there'll be several things that will come up. I have a website, which has been sustained and nurtured by Mary in the UK. That's the official site. I have a blog called Angel in the Dark, and that is because of the book that's been written about my mad life by Johnny Matthews, funny enough. So there is a blog called Angel in the Dark. Apparently I have a page on Wikipedia, which is which apparently is very accurate. I don't know who keeps it up to date. Somebody out there keeps it up to date. And I'm on Facebook and MySpace and all that kind of stuff, but if you just type it in, there's several sites. And I write regularly on the UK site and on both on Facebook and on the blog page on Angel in the Dark. So.
And you do MySpace as well, because I get notices every time you do something on MySpace.
I try and keep it up to date, or my PR, you know, a representative tries to keep it up to date.
Uh-huh.
She complains that I don't tell her everything I'm up to. I think so that's because I'm too busy doing it.
Now, you talked about getting back to music. Was that where you really got your start in entertainment?
Yes. It began at school when I was literally at Ellis High School in Doncaster, junior school, and then or through secondary, what we call secondary school. I got chosen to sing in a couple of musicals that Phil Navas, my then music teacher, was producing at school, Oliver being one of them. And I actually remember the exact moment this happened. I was actually standing backstage in the school hall, because we did have a proper stage scenario with flies and everything, you know, with curtains and everything. And I was waiting to go, and I was waiting for my cue to come on as Oliver. And I was stood at the back, and there appeared to be nobody else about. There was just me. All I had to do was walk through the curtain and walk down the stairs into the middle of the school hall. All the, you know, parents were there, including my own, of course. And I was standing backstage waiting, at the side of the stage waiting to go on. And there's a very strange energy when you're waiting, and the anticipation and the excitement. I remember looking up into the flies where the curtains and the backdrops are and the lights. And it was very quiet and very dark there. But there was a strange buzz on the other side of the curtain. You could almost feel the electricity, the atmosphere, the anticipation. And I remember standing there, looking up and listening and feeling that and going, ooh, I'd much rather be here on this side of the curtain than on that side of the curtain. And it kind of was a calming effect. And I went out and sang, and that was kind of how it all started. From there, my dad had been a musician. He was a singer and had worked at working men's clubs. And so it was a natural progression for me to go for singing lessons and music lessons and then to fall into the music industry, if you like, in Yorkshire. And I started out singing in the working men's clubs, which are famous. This is one of the hardest educations anybody will ever get, is working the working men's clubs, the social clubs.
Oh, I'm sure.
In the UK. This was a baptism of fire. But it absolutely steeled me in terms of understanding audiences for much later on in West End Theatre. So I ended up being a cabaret singer for 2 or 3 years. I ended up doing pantomime in Manchester and doing extra work on lots of different shows where I learned how a TV set and a film set worked. And then ended up going to London, was briefly at Italia Conti Stage School, as a pupil there, and then got my first West End show, which was Dean, about the life of James Dean. And my first West End show, I played all the bad guys in James Dean's life. I played Buzz in Rebel Without a Cause. I did my first on-stage night fight, 1976 or 77, whatever it was. I played the bouncer from East of Eden. I played Victor Moan, who ended up marrying Pier Angeli. And so I played all the nemesis bad guys in James Dean's life, and that was the first West End show I ever did. And when I first came to Los Angeles, one of the first things I had to do actually was go to the Griffith Observatory and stand on the spot where James Dean had actually done that fight in the film. So,
how fun was that?
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because in Transformers, of course, we ended up going back to Griffith Observatory and filming a scene with all the Transformers at Griffith Observatory with the Camaro. With the Bumblebee Camaro. So I was actually on set when we filmed that, and of course I had to wander around and go and take a look at the exact spot I'd stood on 20 years earlier or whatever.
Full circle.
Yep. So musically, I kind of stumbled into musicals, and my next show, of course, was Evita, and the rest is kind of history. I was very lucky to get an audition for Harold Prince, who is probably still legendary as the greatest musical Broadway director and producer of all time, and got the part of McGaldy, and then was transferred. I got managed to audition for Shay, and I was basically told not to embarrass myself because nobody could see me play Shay, because I was very young at the time. And managed to wangle myself an audition and ended up becoming Shay. So I played McGaldy and Shay in the same production for Getting Off for 4 years.
Now, had you come to Los Angeles before you were cast in Robin of Sherwood?
I think the first time I came out here was about 1979. I was coming out to America before Robin of Sherwood, yeah.
Okay.
And now Mark, I know this, but people in the U.S., I don't think have a clear understanding just how popular you and Jason Connery and the whole crew of Robin of Sherwood. You guys are hugely popular in the U.K., even, 20 years later? Or is it 30 years later?
Wow. Don't remind me. It was...
sorry about that.
83, 84, 85. I was asked this, and I'll say this because I absolutely believe it, and I don't want this to sound like I'm being down on British television, but that show could not be made now. That show would not be produced in the UK now. It would cost too much.
Uh-huh.
Richard Carpenter, who wrote the episodes, went so far out on a limb with the way... I mean, don't forget, now it sounds kind of comfortable, but this was the first time in a major family show a pagan icon was shown as being the good guy, and the church was more like the mafia,
uh-huh.
The bad guys. So this was absolutely groundbreaking in its day that you would link Robin Hood to this pagan symbol of the forest, god of the forest, and that the bad guys, the Normans, were basically hiding behind the church. And so at the time it was groundbreaking. What Richard Carpenter did, which was brilliant, was to put all that underlying subtext of this clash of cultures into a family show that you could watch, and you could watch it on several layers, and people still do to this day. They'll watch.
I was just going to say that they still watch it.
They still watch it and go, "What did that mean? Why? What was that about?" You know, and just the concept of adding an assassin, a character who was basically a Hashishion, into the Robin Hood legend was so far out in those days,
uh-huh.
that people were going, "Where is this going to go?" And Richard Carpenter Kip, as we know him, and Paul Knight, the producer, and I must say Ian Sharp, who was the guy that directed Who Dares Wins and why I ended up in Robin of Sherwood. I mean, that vision was so far ahead of its time. So that's why the show has endured. It's because of that richness of layering of psychological elements within the show. And it speaks to people literally across the world. So.
And still today it speaks to them. And, Mark, I saw an episode, and you had hair.
Yes.
And lots of it.
I had a lot of hair.
You did. It was very curly.
I had a lot of curly hair. Yes, indeed. Who knows? I may have hair one day again soon. I know. I don't know. If the doctor takes off, I'll get a transplant from somewhere. I don't know. Yes, I had a lot of curly hair. Yeah.
Now, do you guys still, I believe there's still conventions, are there not?
I believe
that you go to?
Yes, I did one a couple of years ago in Nottingham itself, which was a small but very well attended and fun gathering. And I believe there's plans to have one in Detroit in either 2012 or 2013, something like that, to celebrate the 30 years. It'll be 30, something like that.
Yeah, don't age yourself anymore.
I'll give up. Yeah, anybody listening to this, I'm 29.
And you have regular, 39th birthdays, isn't it?
Yes, the last decade has been 39 birthdays, so,
And I do the same thing.
It's the only way to keep young and active and vital all at the same time. It's just decide you're not going to get old.
Well, speaking
you're perpetually 39, and it's all good.
speaking of not getting old, I have to ask this for my own curiosity. Having had a background in music and theater, how did you get involved? What was the segue? Was there anything you can put your finger on and say that was it that brought you into the graphic novel? I mean, with The Pilgrim coming out and some of the other works that you've done, were you a comic book reader early on, or was there an event that really said, hey, I need to do this?
Yeah, if you'll indulge me again, probably one of the first American comics I ever saw, which my uncle brought back from a trip, I believe, to Canada, was in fact Green Lantern. And this, I was very, very young, and I remember reading this comic book over and over and over again, and was fascinated by the concept of having this magical ring that, you know, you could do stuff with. It was that must have lodged somewhere in the back of my mind. And I'm a very visual writer, so I actually like to visualize stuff and have the ability to look at a scene, if you like, and write it as I see it in my head. And I was joking the other day in an interview and said, you know, sometimes I think there's a movie playing in my head and I'm the only one that's got the tickets. But it developed out of that ability. And for all you would-be writers out there, one of the best bits of advice I got, funnily enough, at a writer's convention that really changed the way that I thought about writing screenplays and comic books was from the dearly revered and respected and now passed away Terry Nation, who was the man, of course, that invented the Daleks and Blake Seven and did so much writing in UK television. I was actually at a convention with Terry Nation. We were sat there talking about science fiction. And an arm came out of the crowd and said, Mr. Nation, have you got any suggestions? I'm a writer. I want to be a writer. What's the best piece of advice you can give me? You know, I write all the time. I've written this. I've written that. I've written lots of material. What's the one piece of advice that you can give me? You know, I want to make this my life and my career. And Terry Nation looked to him and he said, it's very simple, my dear. A writer writes, but a professional writer finishes.
That is so true.
And he looked at it and he went, I bet you've got lots of stuff that you've never finished. How much material you got? And the guy went, I have so much stuff I can never finish it. I'm always adding to it. And he said, that's the thing. Uh-huh. But a professional writer, we have to finish. We have deadlines. So we can write, but a professional writer has to finish. And I literally looked at him, and I slapped him on the back, and I said, Terry, you just changed my life. You just changed my entire writing methodology. And I think from there I wrote a screenplay called Pendragon, which I'd had floating around in my head, which, again, Mike Grell was involved with and actually did lots of artwork, which has never been seen. One day, Mike, I promise you, that script, and we're going to go and do that at some point in the proceedings. So Pendragon, and I wrote it as if I was seeing it as a film in my head. And that was the first time, literally, from pen to paper, brain to pen to paper, if you like, to typewriter. And that's when I kind of honed that technique. And I went, if this works for screenplays, it'll work for comic books.
Was it easy to, I would assume it was fairly easy to translate those characters to Mike, you know, to put out there, to draw those characters up, because, you know, he's just so incredible with his drawings and stuff. Did you have a sit-down with Mike and say, this is what I'm seeing, you know, because I'm sure you visualize what these characters all look like.
Absolutely, and we talk about that. We talk about people that we know, and just for those that don't know about Mike, I mean, I've surfaced in several of Mike's comic books. In fact, lots of people that know Mike will probably never know. But he actually, there was one character in Maggie the Cat called Ryan James. Guess who that's based on?
Gee, I don't know. Who would that be based on?
He does this to lots of people. So, yes, we actually do. We sat down, but to give full credibility to Mike, credit to Mike in this, he's been involved with this process with me for getting on for 15 years because I'm about the third or the fourth attempt. And the other thing about writing is not just about finishing, it's about rewriting. So I have written and rewritten this as a comic book, as a screenplay, as a TV show, as all kinds of different things three or four times, and this is the best incarnation of it. So Mike has been involved with that process in terms of adding ideas and thoughts and visuals to this as long as we've been friends. So that process, yeah, is part of it. And I'll come up with some mad idea, like the design of the bell, and I'll tell you what I think it is, and you'll go away and draw it. Like the icon, which I think is one of the most striking icons. You go look at the pilgrim icon, that eye in the green. That you know, we noodled and tweedled with that for ages, pulling the eye one way, this way, that way, and the colours and everything. And it really pops. It's just such a fantastic, simple design. But the icon itself is so powerful. That's the genius of Mike Grell.
And he truly is a genius. And now, is there a place that the readers can go to read some of the episodes and get them even more interested in your graphic novel that comes out again April 21st?
You can go and see some of the first issues on comicmix.com. If you go to comicmix.com, it will come up. You have to dig in there, and it's the first issues that were run are there. And as I say, it will, as you say, so rightly said, it will start running in hardback, in graphic novel comic form, IDW. And I want to thank the guys there. Never have I come across a more pleasant bunch of guys to sit down and work with. Chris Ryan and his entire team are some of the nicest guys in the business. Very down to earth, very normal, great folks to be around, very creative and supportive. And so I can't praise them enough. They really are good guys.
So again, another shout out to comicmix.com, correct?
Comicmix.com, yep. You'll see some of the material there. And IDW, as some of your readers may know, they're huge in the Star Trek Transformers universe because they print all of the Transformers Star Trek type material. Doctor Who, they're big in the Doctor Who thing as well. So they publish a lot of this material, but very nice guys they are too. So go on, badger IDW. Say, where can I buy the paper?
No, I have to ask if you have a few more moments.
By all means, Ed, I'll stay as long as you like.
Having been on stage and screen, has anybody stopped you on the street and said, oh my gosh, you're Mark Ryan?
Well, I wouldn't say on the street. I was actually, some years ago, I was doing an episode of a show called The Bill in the UK. And there was a very well-known British actor. When we were sitting chatting away and about the golden age of television, and he was talking about how much work he'd done. Don't forget, in those days, it was live television. And he'd done armchair theatres, and he'd done a lot of these shows, Emergency Ward 10. He'd been a regular in lots of these shows. And I was talking about the golden age of television. We were just talking about, you know. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know, after robbing the show, that will probably be the last show like it ever made in the UK that will not be done again. And I had that kind of thought in my mind. And I was waiting to go onto the set to do a scene. And I was just standing there waiting for the red light was on. And there was a young lad there who was playing a police officer. And he was stood there. And as he was stood next to me, he looked at me and he said, excuse me. He said, are you Mark Ryan? I said, yeah, I am. He said, are you the bloke from Robin the Sherwood? Are you Nadir? And I went, yes, I was. I'm very, you know, very proud to say, yes, that was 3 years of my life. I'm very proud of the show. He said, can I say something to you? And I said, sure. He said, you know, that was the golden age of television.
Yeah, I did.
I kind of went, it's funny how things go full circle. You know, it's funny. So we stood there and chatted for a while, and I told him about my still, to this day, friendships with Ray Winston and Clive Mantle, Jason Connery, and all the guys, you know, to this day, and what that show meant to us and how it affected our lives. So it's happened like that a couple of times, and obviously when I go to conventions, people come up with very kind, and some of them say, you know, you affected my life, and you made me think in a different way. And that, to be honest with you, is one of the most humbling things you can have in your life, whether as an actor or any kind of writer or creator, is to have somebody say that to you. And I am extremely lucky to have had the career and the life I've had in this business, in this industry. I understand that. I've been extremely lucky and it's very humbling when somebody comes up and says something you did affected their life in the way carried on throughout their creative journey. So what can I say? I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Well, on top of that, though, Mark, and I mean, I can brag on you. It, you know, you are such a fascinating character, too. And, you know, I've seen you at Comic-Con and how you interact with your fans and at the two film festivals that you and I were in together. And, I mean, you are just very, very accommodating and very kind and gracious. And so, you know, if you didn't like your fans, then I don't think that people would feel that way about you. But you're a very generous, kind man, and I think that shows through in everything that you do as well.
Well, you know, thank you. Again, one learns. You know, when you stand on the shoulders of giants, and I often tell this story. I think I told it at the film festival you were mentioning. When I was doing Evita, I was walking through Soho one day. And this was in sort of 1980, maybe 1981. It was just before I left the show. And as I was walking through, so I saw coming towards me Anthony Hopkins.
Uh-huh.
And this was just, he'd just done Magic. He hadn't done Hannibal Lecter yet. But there he was walking through the rainy Soho street. And I actually passed him by. I actually walked past him and I went, don't be stupid. Just go up and say something nice. So I turned around, I tapped him on the shoulder. Of course, you know, all of them dropped their marks out. You know, but I said, listen, I don't want to stop you where you're going. I just wanted to tell you that I think you're probably the best living screen actor of your generation. I just wanted to say that to you. I've followed you through from The Lion in Winter and Magic and the other things, the other stuff that he'd done, Bridge Too Far. You are, without doubt, the epitome of screen acting that we've turned out in Britain for many, many years. He stood there and he talked to me for about 15 minutes.
Oh, wow.
In a wet, drizzly Soho, Waldorf, about, and he was asking me, what are you doing? I said, I'm doing a show around the corner, Evita, and it's a musical, but I'm hoping to transition into, you know, straight acting to, you know, film and television. And he stood there and he gave me advice. He talked about that for about 15 minutes. I never, ever forgot it.
I bet. And, I mean, he's just such an impressive man altogether. So it's always nice, you know, when you see somebody on film and maybe on Jay Leno or whatever, that when you hear stories like that, they really are good people. It's not just a persona that's been created by great PR people.
No, it's and most of the famous people that I've worked with, and I've worked with quite a lot of them now, are like that. They're genuinely nice people. I mean, sure, some people have good and bad days. Of course, we all do. But for the most part, most people are just human beings, and they're very humble to and very happy to be in the position that they're in and doing the job that they love. I mean, what gift more in life could you have than to be actually paid to do something that you actually love?
That you love, exactly.
Yes, I'm very grateful for that opportunity that this business has given me. And so giving back to anybody that comes up and wants to talk about, you know, their aspirations or their desire to be creative, whether it's writing, acting, or anything else. I'm happy to talk to them. To me, it's not a chore. I'm grateful that I have an audience to be able to say, anybody can do this. I'm a working class lad from Doncaster. My dad was a one-time miner and became a bricklayer, and if I can do this, anybody can do this.
And that is so true. And Mark, I apologize because I did kind of cut you off when you were talking a little bit more about the Wildwood Tarot. And, you know, we only have 7 minutes left, but I thought if maybe you could tell us just a tiny bit more, because before we started the show, you were telling us a little bit more about the Wildwood Tarot. And can you kind of touch on that somewhat?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I'm very excited about it. It's I didn't know whether we'd ever get around to doing it again, and after we did the Greenwood Tarot in the 90s, it became this cult pack, and in fact, recently I was looking online, and it's obviously gone, somebody bought it, but there was one unopened pack on Amazon, and it was $750.
So, unreal.
Yeah, used packs go for anywhere between, I don't know, $100, $300, so in good condition. So Johnny Matthews and I were talking about it, John being probably the world expert on Arthur, and again, an old friend of mine for 30 years, and we were talking about it, and I think that we brought up the fact that Edison Stark, who is the company that we originally took it to, might be interested in revamping it. And originally, the Greenwood Tower was called the Wildwood Tower, but HarperCollins didn't want to use that title because they thought it was a little bit raunchy. So the Wildwood Tower, I know. The Wildwood Tower, I'm nothing I can say. The because, you know, it, what does it mean? It means like Wildwood. Oh dear. So anyway, it became the Greenwood Tarot because obviously that was much less raunchy. And
obviously.
We became what it was, which is this rather, you know, cool thing. So we had meetings with Edison Sard, and I did say I would like to go back and use the Wildwood Tarot name and put back in some of the stuff that was taken out for the other version, and they were happy to do that. And so John Matthews and a fantastic artist called Will Worthington, absolutely fantastic. We revamped the book. We're using the same framework, which is not Kabbalah, it's based on the Wheel of the Year, the European Wheel of the Year. I've done much more writing about the readings in depth and expanded some of the thoughts about quantum mechanics and physics and the act of observing the particle and how the human mind interacts with fate, if you like. Because I don't believe you can tell the future. I'll say that right off the bat. I do not believe that. I believe that you create your reality every time you read a spread. So
I agree.
I think there's possibilities and probabilities, and it's possible you'll do this, it's probable you'll do that, but at the end of the day, it's a decision-making process, and that also explained in the book. So we've now finished that. We have some artwork left over just to tidy up now to finish, but it will be released by Edison Sard next year in Europe, and I believe Sterling Publishing is distributing it in the U.S.
In the U.S. Okay. Ed?
Well, you know, I have to say, Dana, you told me that we would have no problem filling up an hour, and you were right.
Is he not fascinating?
Definitely. I would jump at the chance to host again another hour or two with Mr. Mark Ryan. Hopefully, maybe we could get Mr. Ryan and Mr. Grell together and talk about the Pilgrim and some of their other ventures and their many years of friendship. Mark, go ahead.
No, absolutely. I think that would be great. I mean, don't forget we're going to be, it's released on April 21st, but then, of course, we're going to be running. So maybe next month, you know, for the second edition, we can come back and Grell and I can come back and goad each other for an hour.
and you know, seeing these two together, they really feed off each other big time, too. So it would be highly entertaining.
Well, I tell you, I would jump at the chance to be in the same room with them. I'm gonna ply Dana to see if I can somehow make that happen.
Okay. Well, I volunteer. I'll tee it up. Dana can. If Dana promises not to give Mike Grell quite the Renaissance introduction that she gave me. A little sliver, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, and I think a month probably would be awesome. Does that give you enough time to get some advertising out there? And I know Mike's got a lot of stuff going on too, so, you know, maybe in a month's time, bring you guys both on.
I'm sure we can work it out. I'm sure.
Okay.
That would be great. Our guest tonight has been Mark Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us. His graphic novel, The Pilgrim, is coming out April 21st. I'm just honored and in awe of having been here for this hour. But I know I've got to do some housekeeping here. Dana, thank you so much for co-hosting with me tonight.
You are very welcome.
For those of you who are listening, you can always catch us at blogtalkradio.com/circle-of-7. And at cosproductions.com and at readersentertainment.tv. Thank you both for joining me tonight and for this wonderful hour.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dana. Take care. Good night to all you get and to all your listeners.
Good
evening. Good night.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.